The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
All right. On this edition of Where Did the Road Go, I have with us Andrew Collins, who is a prolific writer who has written books on not only UFOs, but tons of stuff on archaeology, including one entitled Beneath the Pyramids, on tunnels he found beneath the Giza Plateau. Tonight we're going to be talking about his latest book, Light Quest, and his upcoming book on Göbekli Tepe. So welcome to the show, Andrew.
Welcome. Hi, it's good to be with you.
And you've been, when did your first book come out?
1983.
Wow, okay. And what was that on?
Well, it was a local mystery where I live in Essex in England, just about this strange holy well and the medieval mysteries connected with it. And the first few books I did were all local books. But then I realized that my interests were much more sort of national. So I started doing other books. And then, of course, I became international. And my books are presumably known around the world. So, as you say, I do various types of books, from UFOs to psychic questing to almost straightforward history. You know, ancient history, basically.
And every time I read one of your books, you've come up with something that no one else has come up with.
Thank you.
It's actually impresses me to no end the amount of unique information you include in your books. And you discovered the tunnels underneath the Giza Plateau that were supposedly not there, correct?
That's correct, yeah. I mean, presumably it's a different story to what we're going to be talking about tonight, but just briefly, in 2008, myself and my colleague Nigel Skinner-Simpson tracked down first, I think this is important to mention, you know, years of work, we tracked down that there was a lost cave complex at Giza, and we found some journals that went back to the beginning of the 19th century that seemed specifically to mention them. And we were able to pin down exactly where these journals were referring to. And we took an interest in this area of the plateau, which is right in the northwest corner, and were eventually able to get inside a tomb of which nothing was written about at all, other than one mention in the 19th century. And we found a small crack in the darkness within the depths of the tomb that led into a huge cave system that nobody knew anything about. And it was certainly never recorded. There was, you know, I've been doing research on Giza for 30 years, and I'd never, ever seen mention of this. And my colleague, Nigel, you know, he knows virtually every article and paper ever been written about the Giza Plateau and knew it, never been mentioned in any of these. And it was incredible because we were exploring and discovering something that had been completely lost for at least 250 years. It was incredible. I mean, it was like a true Indiana Jones experience. I mean, it was just incredible. And this we discovered within the shadow of the Great Pyramid. I mean, that's how close it was to the Great Pyramid. And yet the strange thing is that there are no hieroglyphs in it at all. It's a natural cave that extends into the bedrock. We think it probably goes towards the second pyramid, not the first pyramid. And there are some weird sort of carvings here and there, which, you know, may be, you know, symbolic in some way, sort of parallel lines and things like this. But other than that, it's actually devoid of artifacts. I mean, I found one small piece of a mummy in there, and we know from the the few, you know, bits and pieces that we've got, that the entrance to the cave system was used by as a local shrine to a bird cult. Presumably this bird was associated with the underworld. We don't know what type because the references are so vague. But, I mean, it would seem that this bird was probably the ibis. And if that's the case, the ibis was the symbol of the god Thoth, or Thoth, who in Greek was known as Hermes. And this almost certainly relates to traditions that Hermes, Trismegistus, the thrice great Hermes, the founder of the Hermetic subject, is actually buried somewhere beneath the second pyramid, and that he holds against his breast the original of the so-called Emerald Tablets, which contain the secrets of creation. And I think that there is a possibility that that this is what's at the end of these tunnels. But of course, as soon as we found them, and we went in there four times in all, twice in 2008, and then twice the following year, in 2009. In fact, sorry, I've got that wrong. It was actually four times, but all four were in 2008. When we went back in 2009, it was now a case of making the whole thing official. And we went to see the director in charge of, the Egyptology, a guy by the name of Dr. Zoe Hawassi, you probably heard of. And we discussed the whole matter with him, and he denied that there were any caves there. And yet the strange thing is that within a few months of us going in there, he went in there with a whole television crew to rediscover it. And he said it was the most incredible journey he'd ever had at Giza. And I mean, he's been to a lot of places at Giza. And for him to say it was the most incredible adventure that he'd had there just shows you the significance and the power of these caves.
Wow. All right. Well, let's move on to your latest published book, which is Light Quest, Your Guide to Seeing and Interacting with UFOs, Mystery Lights, and Plasma Intelligences. And this isn't the first book on UFOs you've written, is it?
No, it's the third. I did two others. One was called The Circle Makers, which was then republished as The New Circle Makers, which sort of had the foundation of crop circles, but then moved very quickly into, you know, well, what is the relationship with UFOs? If there is a connection, what are UFOs? You know, and how do they relate to energies and the landscape and prehistoric sites like stone circles, Stonehenge and Avebury, things like this. And then I did a book called Alien Energy, which took it on to the next level, which basically looked at the idea that UFOs were sort of like these intelligent energy forms that existed and coexisted with us and could even abduct and cause missing time episodes and everything. Well, the latest book, Light Quest, is almost the culmination of those two previous books. I've taken, you know, every idea that I had in those, used that as a foundation point to create almost the whole, you know, science and workings behind looking at UFOs from a different perspective. And I use that word science loosely. Don't get frightened by it. What I was trying to do is show the reality of UFOs as these incredible energy constructs that, you know, not only have substance, but depth and can manifest and even become tangible in the real world and produce aliens and entities and things like this. And yet then evaporate like cantha, as if they were never there in the first place. Clearly, we're dealing with something that's beyond our normal understanding of space-time, something that almost certainly is multidimensional, and that, you know, the aliens that I talk about are pure energy. You know, any forms that you see them in are forms which they want us to see them in. You know, in other words, we might see them as greys, but that's of our creation. These things are so ancient, so old, and they've cohabited with us, you know, not only on Earth, but in the universe as a whole, probably longer than biological life. And they can appear in whatever way they want us to see them. I mean, and, you know, and then you have to look at, well, what are these intelligences? You know, do they live on a planet? No, I think that they can be on one planet at one moment, and then the next minute they can be here. There is no distance or time involved in this. This is something that is manifesting into our world from a multidimensional environment, from a deeper level of reality. What I try to do is to see if there is any kind of information within modern science that actually backs this up, and there is. You know, there are a number of different ideas within quantum physics and quantum entanglement ideas that show how this could easily be a reality. You know, and we know that when you get down into the quantum level, there's so much weirdness that goes on in it that this could be the basis of a new understanding of our relationship to the reality that we have around us. And this doesn't lessen the belief or ideas in UFOs. What it does do is take it beyond the simple explanation that they are nuts and bolts, you know, metallic spacecraft coming here from another planet and arriving here. They're doing things here. They're engineers or whatever it is, are getting out, doing something, getting back into their spacecraft and flying off, which is something which was drummed into us in the late 1940s, the 1950s, and obviously thereafter, mostly from America, mostly in connection with military projects like Project Blue Book and Project Grudge and all the rest of it, that although they were quite anti the idea of UFOs and flying saucers, they bred this concept that, you know, if they were out there, they were hostile and, you know, they contained aliens that were coming here to do bad things to us. And this is something that has seriously affected our approach to this phenomena. And yet there is an alternative, and I see it every summer when I go into the fields of Wiltshire in England. And there are loads of great people there that come from all over the world. You know, they come there to look for crop circles to form. They come to see strange phenomena, to witness balls of light and things like that. And their attitude is completely different. You know, that they believe that they can interact with this phenomena. They believe they can call it up. They believe they can communicate with it. And the belief systems involved with this are getting so complex and so successful that I realized when I was down there, and I lived in Avebury for 5 years, I came back from there, back to my old territory of Essex last year, that these people knew how to interact and understand with this phenomena better than anybody else. And I use those ideas, and obviously my own, because I've been working with these ideas for many years anyway, to put them into a book, which I called Light Quest, to try and take it away from the normal style of UFO books, which are either proving that UFOs exist or proving that they're extraterrestrial, you know, or researching individual cases to prove that they're real and whatever. Let's go beyond that. Let's just accept that the phenomena is there and work with it. Also, try and understand that there are places around the world which we call, in the book, you know, hotspots, UFO hotspots, you can call them window areas or whatever else you want to call them. And these are the most likely places where this phenomena will occur. They are places not only that produce strange lights, but also close encounters as well, including abductions, you know, and missing time episodes. The same places that you get weird bobbing lights, spook lights, ghost lights, earth lights, whatever you want to call them, are also the same places very often where the abductions occur as well. And there is also certain other patterns which emerge relating to these UFO hotspots. You'll generally find that there's some really interesting geology locally. You'll find, for instance, that there's fault lines beneath the earth, you know, huge cracks within the bedrock that have pressures that create earth currents and, you know, and magnetic anomalies and things like this. You'll often find there's a lot of metal or some rare mineral in the area. You will also find that there is a whole tradition of strange lights appearing in these areas within local folklore and legends that will go back hundreds, if not thousands of years. And this is very interesting because obviously today we see UFOs as the product of aliens from another planet. But a few hundred years ago, people saw these as the product of the fairy faith, the elves and the fairies, the little people. And the same stories are there. People would see strange lights. Sometimes they would encounter some kind of weird object on the ground. A door would open up. They'd go inside. And instead of being greeted by aliens, they would be greeted by fairies. And the fairies would be in some strange colloquial situation, dancing and singing and eating and drinking or whatever. And people would remain with them for what appeared to be just, you know, a short period of time. And they would come out. And according to the old stories, maybe a year had passed. Now, this is probably an exaggeration, but it's the same type of reports that we get today in connection with missing time and abduction experiences. It's the same thing. This is nothing new, of course. I mean, you know, the French researcher and writer Jacques Vallée talked about these ideas in a book called Passport to Magonia at the end of the 1960s. John Michel, the Earth Mysteries writer, said similar things. Graham Hancock, in his book Supernatural, talked about these ideas a few years ago as well. You know, and so the reality—it's reality. There's something here, and what I've tried to do is create a book as a handbook for people that are interested in everything that I've been talking about here, and putting it into perspective, and. It's a workbook. It's something which you can take out into the field. You know, even the cover and the way it's designed is as a guidebook, so that if you go out to one of these UFO hotspots, it tells you what to do, what to expect there, what type of meditation to do, how you yourself can call up these lights and possibly have an experience yourself.
And you actually have, for each section, not only do you list where you went, but you even list like where you can park and where the best places to see these things, just as a little excerpt from each chapter.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of awesome.
Yeah. And I mean, we're talking about UFO spots principally in two countries, and that's, you know, the UK and in the United States. I mean, clearly, I could not have included hotspots all over the world. It would have been a mammoth book, a multi-volume set. But, you know, I realise that most of the readers are either going to be in the UK or they're going to be in the United States. So it's done for them, really. I mean, I've got another version of it coming out in Italy, and there's going to be local places in Italy in there, for instance. You know, so it's a universal principle. But the version you've got there is for the people in the UK and the USA.
Okay. And one of the first things you address in the book is you kind of take apart the infamous Roswell incident, which
yes.
so many extraterrestrial believers point to as the absolute proof that they're nuts and bolts crafts. And what did you find when you investigated it?
Well, I mean, I'll be perfectly honest with you. And if I was going to rewrite this book again, I would take out the first five chapters, the first section on Roswell. And the reason being is that the truth of the matter is that I went to Roswell and I was there within an hour and I found evidence that it was everything wasn't all of that it seemed, and that the people that are there are perpetuating a myth which has become so big that it's created its own reality. And a lot of your listeners out there are going to say, well, hold on, I believe in Roswell. Well, that's fine. And that's the very reason why I would actually want to take out those chapters now, because I think my own personal feelings on the subject are perhaps what people don't want to hear. And I've actually taken them out for the Italian version of the book, because it's unnecessary, I think, to, you know, to, as you might say, trash Roswell in the first part of the book, because there's loads of other great stuff in there, which is for everybody. And, you know, that's the truth. I can only tell you the truth. But because I tell you the truth, that's why I wrote the first five chapters of the book. And it really annoyed me what I saw out there, particularly as I'd just come from a place called Martha in Texas, where you get strange, mysterious lights, an object seen, and close encounters and all the rest of it on a regular basis there. But there, the people treat the phenomena completely different. They don't automatically see it as, you know, as aliens in metallic craft or the rest of it. It's a phenomena which can't be explained. You know, everybody's interested in it. Most local people believe in it. Loads of visitors come from, you know, presumably all over the States and obviously other parts of the world. And often they will see something themselves. You know, it's a real phenomena. And there is a much more modern way of approaching it. Whereas if you go to some of the trashy places in Roswell, you know, trying to sell, you know, stupid plastic aliens and all the rest. I mean, everywhere you go, there are trashy alien stuff. And it's fun for half an hour. And then you start thinking, well, if this is what 70 years of ufology has come to, I think that this is very sad.
Yeah, it's just become sort of a pop culture thing and not really.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, as I said, it's fun. It's fun. And if people want to believe in Roswell, that's fine. You know, you might say, yeah, but what about this? And what about such and such a witness and whatever? Well, you know, all of these people came out of the woodwork in about 1980 onwards. Before this time, right the way from 1947, there was the core story from 1947, and that was it. And there is so much evidence of what was going on from 1947 itself that when you start piecing together the bigger picture, you can see that everything isn't actually what you are told. And that most of the documentaries that you see, most of the books you'll read, deliberately avoid the information which I put in this book, deliberately. And I mean, in a way which is actually quite shameful.
Well, yeah, you definitely uncover some stuff I had not heard about Roswell. I've heard a number of believable explanations. I mean, John Keel seems to have dismissed it early on as well. But the newspaper articles you came up with, I don't think I've ever seen anyone mention before.
And do you know where I found them? I found them in the UFO Museum at Roswell itself. That's what I mean. And I found that within an hour of being in Roswell. You know, and that's what annoyed me, that this information was there for everybody to see and everybody ignored it because that's not what they wanted to hear.
Yeah. Well, it seems like it got a resurgence in the 1980s because of a supposed leaked document. And do you think the government had anything to do with intentionally leaking a fake document?
It's possible, yeah. I mean, the one thing that becomes quite clear is that the idea of UFOs and aliens is a beautiful cover story for whatever else you want. And there is plenty of evidence. Nick Redfern, a colleague of mine, has talked extensively about this in his books, that right from the early 1950s, in fact, probably from the 40s, you know, the US military realized that by propagating the idea of UFOs and crashes, they could use it to their advantage in many different ways. I mean, to start off with, the idea of promoting the idea that you have a crash saucer and that you are back engineering the technology from it is going to worry any of your rivals. It's going to worry, you know, in the 50s, the Soviet Union or anyone else that might be looking towards you and thinking, where is the United States going to next with their technology? Plus, if you are experimenting with secret aircraft, to put about lots of silly stories that, you know, there are aliens and all the rest of it around, guarantees that most people will not take the subject seriously, so that when strange lights are seen, perhaps of a secret aircraft, and people report them, they're laughed at because it's been put out that, you know, oh, these are flying saucers and UFOs. So those that report them, seeing the lights or the objects, are going to be classed as nutters, basically, you know. Oh, yes, you've been seeing flying saucers. Ha, 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 yeah, we read about all this. And this covers the fact. Now, that's not to say there's not genuine UFOs, flying saucers, whatever. Of course there are. Of course there are. But they've been pulled into this whole wagon of opportunity that the US military used to their advantage. And, of course, the media itself used to their advantage. And we, of course, are fed these same ideas within films and within, you know, books and comics and things like that. And we take these very strongly. We have a very strong emotional connection with these ideas, whether they be, you know, story episodes in Star Trek or films like Close Encounters of the Third Kind or E.T. or whatever. You know, and I still cry now when I see E.T., you know what I mean? And yet, why? It's a story. It's emotive, though. It's an emotive story which we all want to be real. Do you know what I mean? So to use that to your advantage is a very clever thing to do.
All right. Well, your theory that you outline in this book is not something you can sum up in a few words, but do you want to maybe give people a brief idea of like what an abduction is from the viewpoint of this book?
Well, I'll do it by way of a case, I think.
Okay.
And that's Allagash. In 1976, I believe that was the year, four fishermen were out on a remote lake in Maine at a place called Allagash. And, you know, they were on, you know, a vacation. They were out there. They were doing some night fishing. No one else around. And they saw this ball of light over the forest, you know, beyond the lake shores. And it got closer and closer. And, you know, as they were looking at it, they could see that there were like ripples, almost like magnetic lines of energy coming down. And they actually described it as like a plasma ball. And this object eventually came over the lake itself, at which point one of the guys actually used a flashlight and pointed it at it, and this object immediately just stopped and then started coming towards them and dropped a beam down into the water. The beam went over their canoe, and the next thing they know, it's 3 hours later, they're back on the shore. The fire that they'd lit as a beacon, which should have lasted for at least 3 hours, was now just embers. And, you know, they couldn't remember what had happened. Subsequently, hypnosis revealed an onboard UFO experience, which was pretty consistent amongst all four of the guys involved. So there was some kind of tangible reality to it in some capacity. Something happened to them, and, you know, their stories were cohesive. They matched each other. However, at no time did they see an object with any nuts and bolts or any metallic surfaces. This was clearly a ball of plasma. So these balls of plasma can abduct people and give them experiences exactly identical to those which you might normally associate with metallic craft. How is that possible? Well, let's look at it another way. Is it not possible that abduction experience in general are caused by these balls of light, these energy forms, which can transform? They can, they have, you know, a stability, a hardness, and possibly they can change their density from being a pure energy state to interacting with the human mind to take on a temporary, you know, hard form, basically. And that we interact with them through a process known as entanglement or quantum entanglement. And this is the idea that a particle, when it splits, always retains the link with its other half. And it doesn't matter how far away it gets or even what time it is, because it's happening on a quantum level. It happens beyond time. And if you can imagine literally countless particles in every situation, you'll find that some of the particles in me are some of the particles in you. The other halves are in you, or in any other person in the world, to such a degree that we're all linked in some way, shape or form. Of course, it's the answer for things like telepathy, precognition, mind over matter, various things like this can all start to come into play when you understand what quantum entanglement is about. In fact, to be honest, you can quite literally change your reality with an understanding of quantum entanglement and how it works. But the important thing is that in the same way that we might form a telepathic link with another person, or even ourselves in the future through entanglement, that same entangled link would exist between our minds and the UFO phenomena. So in other words, it knows what we're thinking, and we can actually think something of the intelligence of the object itself. There's a two-way link. And the closer we come to this phenomena, the more our bodies and our minds start reacting to it, because the more we're caught within the electromagnetic fields that it generates, the more reality starts to warp, until eventually I think there is a point where normal space-time breaks down and we enter into a multi-dimensional environment, a total interaction between us and the phenomena, and we enter then what I refer to in the book as a bubble universe, almost like a mini universe created through a jointness between our mind and the phenomena itself. And this can be the interior of a UFO. It can be, the paradise of the fairies. It could be, the heaven itself. I mean, it doesn't matter. A lot of it depends on our minds, the way we perceive it, what we expect to take place. It's like we are instantly projected into this dimensional environment, which is partly of our creation, partly of the creation of the intelligences behind this phenomena. And we're held within it for a period of time, and then it somehow begins to break down, and we're almost like spat out. And now hours may have passed in the real world, in the real space-time. And this, I believe, is the basis behind many abduction experiences and missing time episodes.
Okay. And Rick Strassman, when he did his DMT studies, also showed people entering altered states would have something similar to abduction episodes. Do you think there's a connection there?
Absolutely, 100%. Because the thing is that, what he was achieving using DMT experiences, the encounters with aliens and strange beings and whatever, is something which, when you are actually connected with the real phenomena, takes on a tangibility and a reality, and the intelligence that we're interacting with uses these forms that are being generated within our own mind to take on a physical reality in its own right. In other words, it's feeding off what we almost expect to happen. And what we expect to happen is highlighted by the work of Rick Strassman with DMT, of when we go into an altered state, what type of entities we meet, what they'll look like, what they'll do to us. And it's almost identical to what happens when a person goes into a UFO and finds himself on a medical table, starts getting, probes and things put into them, whatever, bad things happen. And the strange thing is that in medieval times, when people encountered these lights, they would believe that they were dragged to hell and would be tortured by demons. This is, again, it's the same thing. It's just an update. Currently, we see this interaction as meeting aliens, the Greys or any other type of aliens, and it's evolving. Come 50 years' time, it will be something else. And come 100 years' time, it will be something else again. So we have to be careful here what we think, because what we expect to happen during these experiences is what we'll get. So if we start to understand this, we can start to make them much more pleasurable experiences. And what I mean by that is that, you know, if we understand that these intelligences just want to communicate with us, you know, they don't want to create these horrible environments where we're virtually being tortured by aliens. This is of our making. You know, all they want to do is share minds, basically. They want to learn from us. And in return, you know, that they will somehow open up the creativity within us. You'll find that an awful lot of people that have been abducted are creative people. They're artists, they're musicians, they're poets, they're sculptors, they're writers. And all of them, you'll find, generally change after these key experiences, mostly, although not all, for the better. And their creativity becomes at such a peak afterwards. I mean, there's another case I quote in the book, which took place on the top of Silbury Hill. This is in the county of Wiltshire in England, very close to Stonehenge and Avebury. This couple and their friend, they were on the top of Silbury Hill, which is the largest man-made mound in Europe, created around 2500 BC, and they watched these two balls of light come towards them, and they climbed up the side of the hill and then just froze right in front of them. And these were almost like balls of fire, and they then seemed to almost like explode in this blinding flash of light, and everything went wobbly, and they lost about an hour. And afterwards, they started to channel all their energies into creating, music, their own music. They're still producing this to this day. I mean, I know them, they're great people, and I have absolutely no reason to doubt their experience. And yet they said that what they felt they experienced was multidimensional. They did not feel that it was something from outer space. They felt it was something that existed almost it was almost like a dimensional event, as opposed to one relating to a journey from another planet to here.
Right. And Kenneth Ring also showed in the Omega Project that people who have near-death experiences and UFO encounters also have that sort of creativity exemplified afterwards, that it changes their personality and in very common ways between them.
Yes, yeah, and I think a lot of it has got to do with the way that these energies affect our brain. And they are. I mean, there's no question that it's going to do a certain amount of rewiring, in the same way that the rewiring is going to take place if you have things like past life regressions, you know, death, rebirth experiences, things like that. It's the same type of experience, really, just the UFO one is induced through the presence of this intelligent phenomena.
And how much do you think is on their part, and how much of do you think we create and shroud in our own images?
I think that it's probably three-way as opposed to two-way. I think that it's partly of our creation, partly the creation of the intelligences, i.e. what they're feeding from us, what they're taking from us and feeding back. And I think there's an X factor, and I think the X factor is almost like the collective unconsciousness of the planet. You know, in other words, it's almost like the sum total of knowledge of what should take place. So, and I think that we all have that within us, or all have access to it in some way. So in other words, you've almost got like three different elements coming together. You know, us, the intelligence, and almost like the collective unconscious coming together as well to create these experiences. And I think that's why there is cohesion amongst them. And that's why people are able to say, look, you know, these people in the you know, the jungles of Brazil, you know, had this UFO experience. It's the same as the people living, you know, a simple life in Siberia, the same as people living in upstate New York or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It's the same type of experience. You can see similarities. Well, how is that possible? And it can only be because of certain amount of universal information that's contained within us all or is accessible to all of us.
Okay. What do you make of things like the Men in Black and like the paranormal events that people experience after having abduction accounts?
Well, I certainly don't believe that the Men in Black experiences are all to be put down to, you know, to military officials turning up to silence witnesses. I've personally investigated Men in Black cases of people that have no reason to misinterpret what's happening to them. And they talk about weird, mysterious black, you know, sedans turning up, you know, like something out of the 1950s, weird characters coming out dressed as if they're you know, they're from that period. And these are connected with UFO encounters. And I do not believe for a second that these people are military officials dressing up in this manner. It just doesn't make sense. Right. In other words, you have a genuine phenomena here. And John Keel himself talked about the Men in Black a lot. He chased them, you know, and there's one famous story that he gives in one of the books. I can't remember which one it is. I think it's the Mothman Prophecies. It could be another one where, you know, he actually chases their vehicle and it goes down a cul-de-sac and he gets out and walks towards it and actually goes to put his hand on the vehicle and it disappears in front of him. And I always remember reading that as a kid and thinking, oh, my God. You know, and, you know, it's just those sort of experiences affect you. You know what I mean?
Oh, certainly. And do you think it's connected to the plasma intelligences?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the thing is that these plasma intelligences, as I call them, or light intelligences, can take on any form. I think that they take it on temporarily for a very short period of time, you know, maybe a few minutes, you know, maybe even seconds, I don't know, but sometimes hours. And they can keep and hold this form, but then eventually I think that the laws of physics means that they have to let go. And they then return back into a deeper state of reality. This was something that quantum physicist David Bohm referred to. I mean, he did a lot of work on this, on, you know, the quantum reality and the intelligences that might exist almost in this deeper state. And that's them. I'm sure that's them. That's what these things, you know, they exist, they coexist with us, but, you know, they're habitation, when they're not manifesting in this world, is a deeper level of existence. You know, I mean, if you want to call it the etheric plane or whatever, you can, but this is a sort of an occult or new age term. There are scientific terms that people like David Bohm, who was an American quantum physicist who spent a lot of time in the UK at Bristol University, and, you know, developing his ideas, whatever. His books are essential reading, you know, and I talk about his work a lot in LightQuest.
All right, well, we got to take a quick 45-second break, and we'll be back with more with Andrew Collins.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
We should probably move on to Göbekli Tepe.
Okay.
And, this is going to be your next book, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. I mean, the publishers have changed the title. It was going to be called Finding Eden, but they feel that Göbekli Tepe is a much better title, and it's going to be called Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods, which is a good title. And I understand why they've done it and why they want to do it, because there's no question Göbekli Tepe is the main, you know, push in the whole book. I mean, the first half of it is all about it. And obviously some of your listeners are going to be saying, well, what is Göbekli Tepe? Well, let's talk about it. And essentially, in southeast Turkey, in 1995, they discovered a 12,000-year-old stone temple complex, a series of stone circles with T-shaped pillars on which are carved beautiful images of animals and geometric forms and human forms. And this complex is right where the Garden of Eden is said to be in the book of Genesis. It's also where the Neolithic Revolution began, you know, shortly after the construction of this site, you know, the spread of agriculture, the spread of metallurgy, animal domestication, you know, loads and loads of firsts for humanity all began in this very same region where this Göbekli Tepe place has recently been found. Well, I realised that something big had gone on in this area and wrote a book that was published in 1996 called From the Ashes of Angels. And in here, I felt that the prime movers, the shamanic elite that were behind the Neolithic Revolution, lived in this area, had structures, had monuments and settlements, and that they were referred to in Hebrew tradition as the Watchers of the Nephilim of the Book of Enoch. And in Sumerian tradition, they're known as the Anunnaki gods. And that, you know, this is a memory of this elite that existed in this region. Well, this was the book I wrote. Well, then, about the very same time that my book is being published, Göbekli Tepe was discovered. Now, news of it didn't really reach the West, you know, the outside world until the year 2000. So, of course, you can imagine that in the year 2000, when I found out about this, I was absolutely flabbergasted and excited over this. And because, you know, this is what I suggested. And since that time, obviously, I've done a lot of work on it, trying to understand what it represents, its astronomical alignments, who was responsible for its construction, its impact upon civilization, on religion, on myth and legend in this region, and the greater impact on the world. And this is what I'm putting in the book. Obviously, you know, I'll leave quite a lot of it for the actual reading part of things. But what I will say is that there are very specific astronomical alignments at Göbekli Tepe. It's aligned towards the Milky Way, and not just any part of it. There's an area of the Milky Way known as the Dark Rift. Now, this is a dark area that goes right down the center of it, breaking the Milky Way into two separate streams. And this starts in the vicinity of the stars of a constellation called Cygnus, and ends in the area where the sun actually crosses the Milky Way, in the area of the constellations of Sagittarius and Scorpio. And this dark rift has been universally seen around the world since Paleolithic times, so at least 17,000 years, and arguably even 30,000 years, has been seen as the entrance into the sky world, the place of original creation, the place where the souls come from and return to in death, the place of the gods, the place of original creation, the primal cause of reality itself. And this was seen to exist somewhere where the entrance of the dark rift began, i.e. in the vicinity of the stars of Cygnus. And the brightest star of Cygnus which is called Deneb, seems to be the main focus, the main marker. And in the centre of these incredible stone circles, these enclosures, as they're called, at Göbekli Tepe, are two huge monoliths. And these monoliths are like something out of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. I mean, I'm serious. I mean, they really are like this. And there's two of them in every enclosure, standing side by side, like columns, between which are gateways that quite literally were there like stargates to take you from this reality into another dimensional realm, somewhere into the sky world. Now, this wasn't done necessarily physically. This was done through altered states of consciousness, shamanic right. processes, probably involving psychoactive substances or dancing or drumming or sensory deprivation or a mixture of all of these. And I believe that the enclosures were seen as like points of contact with this sky world existing in the vicinity of the Cygnus constellation. And this is something which I bring out in huge detail in the book. But it's just the beginning, really, because once you understand that, you realize that other Cygnus-linked places around the world may all be descendants of Göbekli Tepe. This is where it began. You know, I mean, just recently, Stonehenge has been redated from its a foundation point of around 3000 BC. It now thought to have been in place, or some kind of proto-Stonehenge, as early as 7 to 8,000 BC. Now, this is almost the time frame of Göbekli Tepe, because this was constructed, they believe, around 12,000 years ago, which is, 10,000 BC, and about 2,000 years later, it was abandoned completely, left, completely covered over with earth to form a huge, great mound that remained sacred to the local people right the way through to the present day. But the one thing I can tell you is that I am certain that the pillars, the T-shaped pillars in Göbekli Tepe, or in the various enclosures at Göbekli Tepe, not only represent human figures, and you know, you can see this from the carving, some of them have actually got arms carved in relief along their the sides of their shafts on each side, you know, to show that you know they represent the body of a human, with the T-shaped heads as representing their heads. But that I think, and I show in the book, that they represent the Watchers and the Nephilim of the Book of Enoch and the Anunnaki of Sumerian tradition. I'm pretty certain of this, and I give absolute firm evidence of this to show that this is almost certainly real and the case.
Okay, and you've also written the Cygnus Mystery, which talks about the prevalence of Cygnus in so many
ancient books. Of course, yeah. I mean, and the reason why I wrote that book was that I'd been to Göbekli Tepe in 2004, and I came back from there, and it was all I could think about, just being at Göbekli Tepe, seeing this place, and trying to understand the mindset, the almost alien mindset of the people that created this. You know, a culture that we have no understanding about at all. We were totally unprepared for the discovery of Göbekli Tepe. I mean, although there were signs of this culture in this area, the sophistication, the level of technology was just amazing. I mean, some of the stone blocks that they were using were up to 50 tons apiece. You know, the twin monoliths in one of the enclosures are 18 and a half feet tall. I mean, and that's out the ground. I mean, it's just extraordinary. I mean, you know, I mean, people have been looking for evidence of an Atlantean civilization or culture, i.e. something that existed at the end of the last ice age, and here you have it. This is really it. You know, I'm not saying that the Atlanteans built it. I'm really not. But what I am saying is that there was high culture existing in the world at this time, at the end of the last ice age. Here is the evidence.
Why do you think they buried it?
Well, contrary to certain reports that you will hear, it wasn't all done at the same time. It would seem as if they were constructing the mound around it almost from the time of its first construction. And it was almost like a building project which took 2,000 years to complete. I mean, what they would do is they would build one of these enclosures, one of these sort of stone circles. Burak, just out of interest, the most impressive ones are the oldest ones, out of interest. As the centuries rolled by, the enclosures got smaller and smaller, until eventually, by about 8,000 BC, they were no bigger than a bathroom, with the stones no more than about 5 feet tall. But anyway, they would build these enclosures bit by bit, and they would use them for a period of time, let's say 100 years or 150 years, and then they would cover that one up, build another one and use that one, and do this gradually. So they were building enclosures, they were closing old ones, they were decommissioning them and burying those, and gradually forming a huge great mound that looks like the belly of a pregnant lady, which is what Göbekli Tepe means. I mean, Tepe means occupational mound, mound of human construction, and Göbekli means navel or belly, as in a belly swollen through pregnancy. And I think that there's a clue here as to what these enclosures represent, because, you know, they do seem like womb chambers. And, you know, everything about them seems to suggest that the idea of the shaman, the person going into them, is like returning to the womb. And that this is something which is not done within the material life, it's done in death. Many, many cultures around the world have the idea that the tomb, T-O-M-B, is synonymous with the womb, the W-O-M-B. You know, the two are synonymous. This you will find in ancient Egypt, for instance. The pyramids, tombs, you know, the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, everything. You know, these represented the womb of the Cosmic Mother. And the Cosmic Mother was Nuit, the sky goddess, and she was represented in the sky by the Milky Way. And her womb was actually in the position of Cygnus and the entrance to the Dark Rift. So what was going on in Egypt, in a way, was a descendant, really, of what was going on at Göbekli Tepe several thousand years earlier. And I can show the same thing was going on at Stonehenge. I can show the same thing was going on at some of the mounds in Ohio, built by the Hope World culture, you know, in India and in other parts of the world. You know, even, say, the Great Pyramids. You know, most people will tell you that the Great Pyramids are aligned to Orion. Well, actually, it doesn't really work. When you actually look at it on paper, there's a lot of fudging going on. Much more likely is that they are aligned to Cygnus and the Milky Way, which features very heavily within their creation myths and funerary rites.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that was actually my next question, so you beat me to it. How much of this has not been uncovered, and could any of it be older than what we have already uncovered?
Yeah, good question. Well, to start off with, the oldest enclosures so far are giving dates in the region of 9,500 BC. So it's 11,500 years ago. However, so far they've only uncovered about a tenth of what is beneath this huge great mound. The mound itself, I can't remember the exact dimensions of it at the moment, but I think it's about it's almost 300 meters across. Don't quote me on that, because the actual amount has gone out of my head at the moment. But it's huge. It's a massive, great mound. It's like a hill. It's a man-made hill, huge man-made hill, and they've got a lot to go. I mean, you know, they some estimates suggest that there could be as many as another 20 of these enclosures, these stone enclosures with their T-shaped pillars, still to be found. Now, the lead archaeologist there, a guy by the name of Klaus Schmidt, a German guy, he feels that what we've uncovered so far is the end product of a gradual evolution of technological ideas and communal spirit that goes back several thousand years, and that we will find evidence of that activity at Göbekli Tepe. In other words, it was a gradual emergence, and we just happened to have found some of the best enclosures that they made. However, I look at it differently. I think that there's a good chance that the oldest enclosures, which are the most sophisticated, may have been the ones that came first, and that the people that inspired the creation of Göbekli Tepe came from elsewhere in the ancient world. As to where, that's a big, big mystery. It's one that I tackle in the book, and I think I've got the answers. But the one thing I will say is that it's likely that one of the influences was from the Nile, in obviously North Africa and the area that we now know as Egypt. There is good evidence of Egyptian activity in the so-called Levant, i.e. the area of Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, dating back to just before the age of Göbekli Tepe. So the likelihood is that there could have been an Egyptian connection there. However, I think that it's more likely that there were two or three main influences coming to bear on Göbekli Tepe, coming from different parts of the ancient world. But they didn't build it. They got together with the local people who were already engaged in their own building construction and transformed these sacred environments. They supersized them. You know, before that, they might have been creating little tiny huts that might have been dedicated to, you know, religious activities. But then suddenly, they're creating these massive, great monuments, you know, where with stones up to 50 tons apiece, with these huge monoliths or whatever. Something changed. And that, I'm sure, is not something that gradually evolved over several thousand years. It's a product of circumstance. Something big had happened, and it was a response to that. Well, I mean, I can say, and I've said this before, that I think that they were responding to the fact that there'd been a massive cataclysm in the world, and that, you know, bad things had happened in the world, and there was a certain fear that unless, you know, they appeased the gods, if you like, then these things could happen again.
Huh. All right. Do you think that there could be another Göbekli Tepe out there somewhere buried under the dirt?
I'm almost certain of it. I mean, if we've just redated Stonehenge from 3000 BC to 7,000 to 8,000 BC, that unquestionably means that in many other parts of Europe, and in the Near East, Russia, Central Asia, you will find other similar monuments to this. Now, whether they're slightly older or slightly younger than Göbekli Tepe, I'm not sure. We'll have to wait and see. But I would predict that you will find Göbekli Tepe-type structures that have spread out from that area. So we're talking in areas like Armenia, the Caucasus, the Russian steppes, and in certain parts of Europe, Eastern Europe. They would probably be, I don't know, maybe let's say 8,000 BC, something like that. But there's got to be precursors to this style of, you know, what we call cosmic architecture, you know, or monumental architecture. It didn't just come out of nowhere. You know, yes, there was architecture on this scale somewhere going on. Now, the only real evidence that we've got of that is at Jericho. Here, this massive, great tower, you know, many yards thick of walls, was created around the whole of the Jericho. And this was possibly as early as 9 to 10,000 BC. They built this massive defensive wall of stone. And beyond that, they cut into the bedrock a huge, great circular ditch. I mean, there's no question that the inhabitants of Jericho were trying to keep something out. Absolutely no question. And it wasn't just the bad weather or you know, a few marauding, you know, tribesmen or wild animals. Something big was going on. So the style of architecture begins at places like Jericho. But what's happening at Jericho is defensive. It's not religious. There's almost no evidence of religious activity there at all during this age. But the skills are being made there. You know, the skills of being able to use large blocks, create large structures, are in place. You know, the engineers are there, the technicians are there. You know, all you need to do is then move these guys, put them at Göbekli Tepe and say, look, lads, you're doing something different now. You're creating religious monuments. And, you know, you could create something like Göbekli Tepe fairly easily.
Okay. How do you think they moved the blocks?
Well, I think they probably just dragged them or whatever. I don't know is the honest answer. I mean, I've seen documentaries that show means of how they could have done it. And, I mean, it's the old, you know, the old story, isn't it? Stonehenge, the Great Pyramid. How did they do it? How did they put them up? Well, my interest is why, not how.
Okay.
I'm not actually that interested in how, because somehow they did do it, and that's all we need to know. I'm more interested in why. Why create the Great Pyramid? You know, why create Göbekli Tepe? Why create Stonehenge? What was the motivations in the minds of the people responsible for these structures? That's what I'm interested in. And why am I interested in that? Because I want to see evidence that it wasn't simply the fact that they got up one day and said, oh, I know what we'll do, we'll create Stonehenge. That there was something else going on. They're being motivated to do it by higher intelligences. You know, that's what I'm interested in. In the same way that psychics today can communicate with intelligences, similar stuff would have been going on back then. There's no question of this at all. The shamans, you know, the priests, the magicians, all the rest of it. And I believe that some of those communications are real. They're in touch with very real intelligences that exist and coexist with us, whether they be plasma-based, whether they be physical, you know, or whether they're communicating with us in mind. You know, to me, if we are in communication with extraterrestrials, it's not through speaking to them one-to-one, mouth-to-mouth. It's through the mind. You know, the mind is the most powerful thing in the universe, and there is no question with the vast distances in space between stars that, you know, God or the universe, whatever you want to call it, will have developed an easier way of communication of between races living on different planets and different parts of the universes, even in different mediums. You know, some living in dust clouds, others living, you know, on the physical planet, others living within water, whatever. That there are ways, there are easier ways of communication, and that's the mind, you know. And I think that we have been in touch with proto-intelligences, interdimensional intelligences, probably even extraterrestrial intelligences for tens of thousands of years, and that in many ways they have been affecting human evolution.
All right. Well, you're on WVBR FM Ithaca, and we've been talking to Andrew Collins. The name of the new book is what?
Well, that's going to be called Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods, and I'm hoping you're going to invite me on when that book comes out, and I'll give you the full story of what it contains. And so I'll see you next year on that one.
Okay, and that's coming out in 2014?
Well, I'd like to see it by the end of the year, but if it gets pushed into early 2014, then so be it.
All right, and your website?
AndrewCollins.com. LightQuest is the name of the book on UFOs. And, you know, come and check out the site and, you know, come on to Facebook as well. Always happy to communicate.
All right. Well, thank you, Andrew. The Last Exit for the Lost is up next, and here's some Psyche Corporation to take you out.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Counting. Can you hear?